Walking a path along the roots of Pike's Peak, you take a fork in the road to the Anselm Society Digital Pub. Inside is a raucous conversation on the arts, faith, and whether any of us can name the seven wonders of the ancient world. In a corner by the fire are three people. One of them is listing off on his fingers, okay, Pyramid of Giza, Hanging Gardens, Colossus of Rhodes, something about Ephesus, Statue of Zeus? Anyway, that's me, Matthew Melema, and welcome to Believe to See. We're a podcast of the Anselm Society Arts Guild. Here at Believe to See, we explore the relationship between faith, art, and storytelling. Our goal is to connect the great story, the great stories, and our own stories so that we can better understand what it means to live with a Christian imagination. Now, I want to start off by talking about a feeling that we've probably all had at one point, whether we are active artists or somebody who, you know, just has an abiding love for the arts. Our guest today might call this feeling an internal world of joy. Maybe you first felt it when you were a kid and you were playing in the garden, or reading Anne of Green Gables for the first time, or, in my case, going on a class field trip to the Natural History Museum to see the T-Rex skeleton. I get a feeling that most every child feels that feeling at some point. But if you're the sort of person who's listening to this podcast, you're probably still feeling that internal world of joy. Maybe you've even felt the urge to share this with the world, you know, to create a portal for others to share in your joy, to awaken them to the other. And that always sounds amazing, you know, at least at first. But when you start the actual process, things get hard. The obstacles of daily life keep popping up like an endless loop of whack-a-moles. Then there are the internal obstacles, you know, those nagging feelings of doubt about your ability or whether your story is even worth telling. The thing that originally seemed like such a source of pure joy can somehow seem like a burden. And if that's what you're feeling, you're, weirdly enough, in luck. Because our guest today has been on that trail with you, and she has a brand new novel exploring that very struggle. But first, let's introduce our co-host for today. You know her and love her, Mandy Houck. Mandy, how are you doing?
Hi. I'm great. That was a boost for me. They know me and love me. Thank you. I'm good. I'm having a good day. How about you?
Oh, I'm doing okay. I don't mean to make too much of my plight, but I'm fighting off a minor cold. And, you know, it's a stereotype that, like, husbands always, you know, are big babies about colds. And that is true for me. So, you know, everyone, keep Danielle in your thoughts. She's going to have to put up with me whining about being congested. But other than that, I'm doing great. And I am really, really excited to introduce our guest for today. Our guest is Tracy Higley, and she is a writer of, well, I'll let her describe it in more detail, but suffice it to say, she's written a lot of novels that I find very interesting and which I'm going to probably pester her about after we're done recording. And she also has a new novel that is coming out that we want to talk about, and it is called Nightfall in the Garden of Deep Time, and it's about, well, is it a little bit reductive to say what a novel is about, Mandy? Am I just...
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to, but I would hope, if you can sum it up satisfactorily, then that's probably not a... I mean, the best kinds of novels can't be summed up quite that easily. Okay. But I would think Tracy would probably be the best one.
You're right. Maybe we should bring Tracy to the table and let her discuss
her own work. We should talk to Tracy.
Yeah, so Tracy, welcome to the pub table. We're really happy to have you.
Thank you. This is a delight. I've been listening to you guys for a while. I do know you and love you, Mandy, both of you, all of you. So yes, I've been listening for a while and just, I love what you guys are doing. So it's a joy to be here. Thanks.
Great. Well, speaking of joy, I want to start off by talking about the concept that I heard from you, the internal world of joy. So let's have you define your term, what you mean by this internal world of joy, and where you have found it in your career.
So I think when I think about joy, I think of it in sort of the C.S. Lewis kind of terms, you know, that feeling that isn't necessarily connected to happiness or to situations or circumstances, but it's more of that, the way that he kind of described that longing or almost a feeling that is like nostalgia, but a lot of times it's sparked by beauty, but it kind of just makes us awaken to something more. You know, we just realize that there's more out there than just the everyday that we encounter, and there's a kind of a longing for it. I think everybody feels it. I think, you know, we all, a lot of times, like I said, it's sparked by beauty, maybe nature, you know, maybe a little baby or something like that. But we all kind of feel that little spark of something that that Lewis defined as joy, but we could probably call it a lot of different things.
Okay, now let's get to your particular spark of joy. I'm sure you have many, but the one in particular I'd like to talk about is the subject of a lot of your novels. And one of the reasons I'm particularly interested in is it is one of my sparks of joy, too, and that is the ancient world. So tell us about your background with that and how you've incorporated it into your novels.
Yeah, I don't know. So I've always been fascinated by the ancient world. I'm not really sure why. I don't know if it was, you know, Bible stories from the Old Testament as a kid that got me intrigued in that. But I always found myself kind of wondering and fascinated by the people who were outside of the Bible stories, the pagan temples and all of that kind of thing, just the ruins and the ancient world in general just always intrigued me. Ancient Egypt and Rome and all those places. And so going through school, I was always a history buff and went on and studied history in graduate school and all that, and just, you know, really loved getting deep into all of that and incorporating that into story, because I've had a love of story my whole life as well and always loved writing. So yeah, always kind of sparked by ancient history. But also I think there's something about it too that's not just the dry academic stories of ancient history, it's also the setting. So there's a lot in me that is kind of sparked by place and by specific places. So I think that's why I keep repeating the word like ruins and temples and things like that. Like you can hear that place feeling in what's really fascinating to me, not just the characters, which of course are, but also the places themselves. And so a lot of the books that I've written have been set in a particular place, and that's been that place that has kind of started off the story more than the plot or the characters. That's kind of where it began. In the place. So you had mentioned the Seven Wonders. And so I have books that are set in each of the Seven Wonders of the ancient world and in some lost cities like Pompeii and Petra. And so a lot of times it's that place that kind of just lights me up. And I love nature and the outdoors and stuff too. You know, it's not just history that is interesting to me.
I definitely find setting to be super important. Like to me, if I'm reading a novel and the setting isn't integral to not only the plot, but to the inner life of the character, if it doesn't inform the fears and longings and drive of the characters, then that it just doesn't, it's not as rich of a world in the story. So the setting, I like, my favorite kinds of books are where the setting might as well be a character. Mm.
Yeah,
and that's definitely what you write.
I've actually even done that a little bit with, you know, kind of just fiddled around a little bit on the edges with making setting a character in some of my books. In my Pompeii book, I actually have little tiny scenes from the point of view of Mount Vesuvius, the volcano that erupted and buried the city. So it's like Vesuvius is a character in the story.
Oh, yeah. Hey, the book I'm writing, The Barn, has two chapters.
Yeah.
The Barn Talks.
So yeah, we're on the same wavelength there
for
the setting.
That's
for sure.
Awesome.
And I really do think that, you know, part of storytelling and part of why we come to stories is to sort of step into this other setting, this other world. And so that's one of my, you know, really kind of highest values as I'm writing, is to weave that in so people feel like they've kind of taken this journey and been transported to this other place where they can see it and smell it and taste it and hear it and, you know, all of that. It's a very sensory experience where they feel like they've actually traveled somewhere different. I think that's really kind of why we read. That's one of the big reasons we read.
Yeah. And related to that, I'm kind of interested how you put the pieces together, because I noticed on your website, you talked about having a master's in, I think it was like ancient and classical history. And so I'm wondering, like, did you go in there thinking, you know, maybe I want to be an academic or maybe I want to do this or that. Then you transition to becoming a novelist, or did you go in like, hey, I want to do this because I want to incorporate it into my books?
Yes, the latter. I mean, for the most part. I my undergrad work was in English literature, so I was, you know, planning to go into teaching, and that just kind of never happened. But along the way, I just started writing. And so, yes, I've been writing for about 20 years or so, publishing and writing for about 20 years. But yeah, and then along the way, I thought I would really like to deepen my understanding and knowledge of history. And so went back to grad school for the master's in history, more just to inform my writing than for any other reason.
Yep. And I want to focus on this internal world of joy concept, because I think it's really interesting. It got me thinking. So this will surprise no listeners who've listened to more than like half an episode. But my main inspirations for my writing, my sort of internal world of joy, is some convergence of ancient history, you know, basically history before guns were invented. I'm all in for. I think the gun made everything so much less cool, but before that, I'm in, especially ancient Greece, Rome, Japan, whatever. I'm all in. And also, again, all the listeners who've listened to more than one episode are saying it all together, dinosaurs, which is something I have loved since I was, you know, since I had memories. So first of all, I want to direct a question to Mandy. Mandy, you write very different books from me. What is your yes. internal world of joy? How does that influence your work?
You know, it's interesting because I've written three books, and hello, publishers, come find me. No, something that I have discovered, I always have water in my books, typically creeks. And unsurprisingly, there was a creek that ran behind our house when I was a child, right around the time that I started learning to read and write, which was when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And my sister and I would play in the creek in our backyard. And it's just interesting how that stays. I mean, I'm 53 now, so it's literally almost 50 years later. Ugh. And I try not to make age jokes. I'm just very, anyway. But it's how God really connects with us in very specific personal ways. And I can't really explain why creeks, other than, why was I even enchanted by that when I was younger? I don't know. But creeks are always in there. Music, nature in general, my characters, the protagonists in particular, are very connected to the natural world around them, and they see something in it that perhaps other characters don't see, and it changes who they are. So my internal world is very much about creeks and birds and flowers and things like that. And you like, Matthew, you like to write books prior to the invention of the gun. I have committed, I don't think I will ever write a book that include cell phones, because
they change everything.
As I sit here talking on one, so I am a hypocrite. But it just makes it less interesting to me. But
I like those self-imposed rules. I can't have guns. You can't have cell phones.
Well, and you don't want to drop the cell phone in the creek.
It all comes full circle. So Tracy, I'm wondering what your take is on this, because something I was sort of wondering as I was going through the questions for this is, do you think to be, you know, an effective artist, do you need to have some sort of internal world of joy that you can like draw from for the art?
I would think I would say no, and maybe you'd be surprised by that answer, but here's why. I think that I think for art to be expressed, whether we're writing or, you know, any type of creative endeavor, I think we have to have something that we're trying to say. I think there has to be something that is trying to be expressed. I think that is almost synonymous with art, is expression. And I think that that thing has to be kind of bubbling up inside of us and wanting to get out. And we're driven to express and move past, you know, some of the obstacles that are in our way in order to express that, because we want it to come out. But I think what I would say as to whether it needs to be joy is that I think I have to say no, because I look around and I see a lot of art that seems to be informed by hopelessness and cynicism and despair. And there are people who are creating And we could, you know, we could debate the value of what they're creating or the beauty of it or, you know, the ugliness of it. But I think some people even try to create ugliness. I mean, their intention is to create ugliness. So as to whether it needs to be joy, I don't think it has to be in order to create. I think you want to have to say something. You have something that you want to say. But I think for us who, you know, we want to be part of that larger story, that larger redemptive story with a capital S, I think for us, it certainly should be. There should be joy at the core of that. You know, I wouldn't think that to create, to sub-create, you know, really in a biblical sense would be to create something out of hopelessness or despair.
I think even in the laments, even though it starts from a place of whether it's a lamenting psalm or an actual lament from Lamentation, you feel that the impetus is the creator of the lament is seeking hope and joy because it's not there's no apathy. It's mm-hmm. So even though they're starting from a place of sorrow or confusion, like how long, O Lord, mm-hmm. They're still saying how long, O Lord, because they expect him to answer. Yeah. So that hope is sort of in there anyway. And it's that longing for joy that they once had and that they know that God is present enough and powerful enough and good enough to show them again. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, that's got me thinking because I'm guessing, I think you mentioned this, Tracy, like that there is a place for art that's born out of other things, you know, like Mandy just talked about sadness. You can imagine art where that's born out of anger and maybe appropriate anger. Like first example that popped into my head was Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal. Like that was definitely born out of anger, but I think we can all agree that was a righteous anger and it was worthwhile. But would you say that art in general born out of joy is higher, more desirable than the other art? Or do you think joy is one of those sources of art among other equally valid sources?
I think it goes back to how we're really defining joy. You know, mm-hmm. are we saying joy is just all positive feelings? It's all, you know, rainbows and unicorns? Or are we saying that joy is kind of that bedrock knowledge that, you know, God is sovereign, that there is a greater story, that we are part of it? And I think, you know, sadness and anger even can come out of that, just like Mandy was saying, whether it's the Psalms or even, you know, modern contemporary work can be all part of that. But that joy is really more the idea that there is something more, there is something other than me. There is a greater story going on here. And so there's no hopelessness. There's no, you know, that there can be no light. There may be darkness right now, but we know that there is light, that light exists. And I think that's really kind of what the joy is about, more than just the happy feelings or the, you know, the positive, you know, happy feelings all the time.
Yeah, I think that's really good way to nuance the point. Because I can picture some people joking like, art shouldn't be happy, blah, 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 blah. And you're saying, no, joy does not equal, you know, slapping a smile on your face. It can include all these other emotions as well.
And like I said, even the way Lewis used the word, I mean, it was really more about this kind of almost painful longing, you know, this feeling that this world can't be all there is. There has to be more. There has to be more than this. And in that longing, there was a bit of discontent, you know, a bit of this sense of, you know, I want more than what I have here. I want more than what I see. I want something that's over the horizon or around the bend or hidden behind a door or through a wardrobe or, you know, whatever mm-hmm. it was. That there was something more, and that longing could even be felt almost like a pain, you know, almost like pain. So it's not just all, you know, rainbows.
Yeah. And so going further into this whole concept of the internal world of joy, I can imagine, you know, some artists, you know, writers, painters, whatever, thinking, okay, I love the process of creating. I just, what kind of world of joy can I have? So if you're talking to someone who's like, I don't know where it is, can you take steps to find out what your world of joy is? How'd you go about that search?
Yeah, I think part of the key is actually what's something that Mandy alluded to already, and that is childhood, is just really going back and thinking, you know, what was it that fascinated me or that has always fascinated me? What is it that I've been always drawn to or always kind of wanted to dig deeper into or you know, felt mystified by, or, you know, for you, it's dinosaurs or whatever it might be. I loved mysteries growing up. I loved the puzzles and the problem solving and, you know, I still love crime drama and, you know, those kinds of things. So, mystery has always been really a draw for me, as well as nature and settings and things like that. So I think part of it is tapping back into childhood and tapping back into like, what are those things that I've always, really loved. But I think also part of it is just being aware. It's really kind of just giving yourself time to be present in the things that do spark your imagination. I think we're all constantly getting sparked by things. And I think across the board, everyone feels that way. I think the artist is different in that they feel driven to also express that in some way and create something that expresses it. But we're all getting sparked all the time. And I think that just being able to pay attention, and that's actually where this newest book that I have coming out came from, is that I did this really kind of weird thing back in earlier this year in January. I don't usually go in for writing exercises. I'm very productivity and efficient minded. And so to me, if I'm going to take the time to write and go through all the angst of all that, I don't want it to be like wasted on an exercise. I want it to count for something, you know? So I don't usually do writing exercises, but I came up with this idea and I just thought, I'm going to try this because I was ready to start my next book and I had no idea what it was going to be about. And so I thought, I'm just going to start what I'm going to call my inspiration jar. And I just started writing down, and at first it was a document, but I just started writing down everything that would occur to me over a period of time that I felt like sparked my imagination. So it kind of was these things that were like joy to me, you know, and it was a whole bunch of different random stuff. I mean, it wasn't all kind of one type of thing. Some of it was just like a word. I love the word shimmer. I love the word portal. I love, you know, there's just different words. Some of it was movies I love, or tropes and, you know, genres that I love, quotes. It was just anything that just made me kind of stop and go, oh, I love that. You know, that just kind of gave me that feeling. I would write it down. I would put it in this thing, in this document. So when the document got up to like 75 different things, which didn't actually take that long, believe it or not, because I think the key is paying attention. It's just starting to really be aware and be present in the things that inspire us. When it got to be about that long, I printed it all out and cut them all up into slips of paper and folded them in half and put them in a bowl. I was going to have my inspiration jar, but it ended up being an inspiration bowl. But
oh, it's there! She's
showing us the bowl right now.
We're on camera, so I'm showing you the bowl of pieces of paper. So I pulled it out before we started. But so then this exercise that I did, what I did was every morning I took out two pieces and I put them in front of me. And I just thought about, okay, what is it that I love about these things? And then I tried to find a way in which they connected. So they were just random things that had no real connection, but I tried to force a way in which they could connect. And then I just free wrote for about half an hour or so. And then when I kind of felt like that was petering out and I got to the end of it, I pulled a third slip out and then said, okay, how does this third slip connect to the other two? And I started writing. So anyway, I did this for, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, pulling these out until I had used them all up. And a story came out of it. It was just the weirdest thing. It was this, because there were so many different ways in which they connected to all the things that I love and all the things that interest me, I just started thinking, oh, like, this would be cool and that would be cool. And I found myself thinking about it as I was falling asleep at night and, you know, just kind of starting to develop the idea for this story. And so it kind of was this blend of all the things that bring me joy. So it was just fun. I'd never done that before in a book. You know, all the other books that I've written so far have all been, like I said, kind of born out of a certain setting or time period or whatever. But this was something different. So it was fun.
I love that. That's such a personal stamp of you. Like, you're all over the book. I mean, yeah. As writers, we always are. But that's like, I really love that. That's intriguing. That's cool.
Yeah. And for sure, this book is more autobiographical probably than any other book that I've written, just for that reason.
Yeah. And I want to get to talking about the book because, you know, it's going to do a good job encapsulating a lot of the things we're doing. And as a segue, I'm going to dwell on the word portal. Okay. Anyway. So
Well done.
Thank you. So you talk about using your art as like a portal for others. What do you mean when you talked about how portal is one of your words that sparks joy. So what is it about portals that appeals to you? And what is it about your work that you want to make portal-like?
Yeah, I think probably like, you know, just about every other person my age, one of the really formative books of my youth was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And I think that idea that felt so fresh, it doesn't feel fresh anymore because it was so formative for so many people that now, you know, everybody's stepping through portals everywhere. but I think at that time, I think Lewis's premise was very fresh for people and, you know, for children. And that idea that something so ordinary, like just a piece of furniture tucked away in an unused room, could open us up and you know, have us be able to have an entrance into something completely other, you know, this whole other world where children could be treated like adults and we could have adventures and, you know, all of that. That I think, yeah, it was, like I said, formative for me for sure. And I knew from a young age that I not only wanted to step through a portal in some way, but that I wanted to make portals for other people to step through, that I wanted to make something that gave people the feeling that I felt when I went through the wardrobe. And so that's just always been a part of me, is wanting to create stories that that people feel like they've been transported, like I said before, like they've gone on a journey, they've stepped through into another place. And so partly that's the ancient world for the, some of the books that I've written, but I've also written time travel books and some magical realism and different things like that, that, you know, where even the characters are stepping through into something different. Because yeah, that's just always been intriguing to me. So yeah, so I hope the book is a portal. You know, every book I write, I want to be a portal, basically.
Yeah. Let's talk about the purpose of this book. Again, Nightfall in the Garden of Deep Time. Listeners, you should know that we are recording this podcast in late October. If I understand our producer Jesse's schedule correctly, this one will be coming out about mid-November. And that's perfect because Tracy's book, Nightfall in the Garden of Deep Time, comes out November 8th. So it'll be hot off the presses. So take a give it a look. But like you intimated, this is a little different from your usual. So you seem to write a lot of historical fiction. Like I said, you have other things there too. But this is set, I believe, in contemporary times and has more autobiographical themes. And that brings us back to your inspiration jar. So did you do the inspiration jar with the thought, okay, I want to write a different kind of novel, maybe this will get things going for the novel? Or did you do the inspiration jar like, yeah, we'll just see where this goes, I don't have a plan?
Yeah, I think I did the inspiration jar because I'm getting to a point in my life, being of a certain age. I won't say what. Actually, I'm the same age as Mandy, so I'll just say it.
Yay!
Yes. Yay. Great. But, you know, I'm getting to the age where I feel like, you know what? I want to write what I want to write. And I'm not necessarily going to just write what I think will sell or what the market wants or what other people say or what publishers want. Or, you know, I'm going to write what really lights me up. And so that's what I asked myself. Okay, well, then what lights me up? And I thought, I'm not sure. I got to think about that. And that was kind of where it came from, was me just saying, I'm going to write whatever comes out next. If it's not on brand, if it's not, you know, doesn't fit a certain mold, I don't care. I'm going to write whatever I feel like when I want to write. So that's where it came from.
Yeah, that's my favorite thing about being in my 50s. Everyone always said that, but it is so true. You learn to go, whatever. Yes. If you don't like it, it's fine. Yes. It's too much energy. I'm just going to do what I feel led to do.
And yeah, for sure.
Yeah, the freedom.
I read a tweet somewhere saying that all of us, when we're in like our teens and 20s, we get messed up because we care so much about fitting in with the crowd that we just conform. And that, you know, starting in your 30s and moving on, it's all about regaining and being that beautiful, unique weirdo you were as a kid. And I've been noticing that with myself too. It's great not feeling like you have to fit in anymore. But Tracy, we've reached that point in the podcast now. Why don't you give us like the elevator pitch, like the synopsis for Nightfall in the Garden of Deep Time?
Okay. So basically the main character, Kelsey, is a bookshop owner. She owns a bookshop in the city, and the hotel development is going on. And so she's in crisis because she's afraid she's going to lose her bookshop. So that's kind of what she's worried about. But she's also an aspiring writer, and she has been just sort of refusing that call for a long time because of a lot of different reasons that we all refuse that call for. But she basically is just focusing on the practical and, you know, trying to keep life going. But one night she is walking past this empty lot, which is next to the bookshop and has been behind a wall and a gate her whole life. And she, through the gate, thinks that she sees a light shimmering, because, you know, I love the word shimmer.
That's that word.
Got that word in there. Yep. So she sees this little shimmer going on and she can't figure out what it is. And so basically, eventually she finds her way into this empty lot, which turns out to be this perpetual nighttime garden where all these famous artists and musicians and writers who are dead are having this kind of ongoing garden party in this beautiful, beautiful garden inside this empty lot, which is bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. So she stumbles in there and they're basically challenging her and really trying to encourage her to pursue her true identity as a storyteller and kind of pressing her to go deeper. And so then she starts to fall into some other adventures, which I'll leave for readers to figure out. But getting into some different more dangerous adventures that are challenging her to really step into who she is as a person. And so, yeah, so there's fun plot twists and some cameo appearances by famous people that we all, wish we could have met for real. But
it's like a fantasy pub table.
Yes.
It's like our fantasy pub tables.
Yes, and they're all, and to have all those people in one place who weren't actually contemporaries was kind of fun, right. Just put a bunch of different people in there. But yeah, I am hoping that it's really tremendously encouraging for anybody that's pursuing a creative life, because I think we all do really run into these obstacles. I think it's universal. If you're trying to be an artist of any sort, you're going to hit these walls that are really, really hard to overcome. So the point of the story was really to trace Kelsey's journey through those obstacles, but also in a way that would help anybody who is struggling with some of that.
Yeah, and you mentioned, that this novel is much more autobiographical than some of your previous novels. And I'm especially intrigued by that in the sense of, the obstacles. Tell us about the obstacles that you gave to Kelsey, maybe that you've related to, or that, you've seen other writer or creative friends relate to. What do you think some of those major obstacles are that you've seen?
Oh my goodness. There's so many. So where to begin, right? I think that, there are sort of the practical external kinds of things that, that we hit. So there's just the lack of time and there's the responsibilities of family and work and all of the things that seem to call at us and our duty and responsibility. And, to be able to get past those is challenging. There's no real answer to that. We just have to figure it out. But again, I think, getting to a certain age myself, what I'm discovering in the past couple of years is that even when you clear out some of those things, because of life circumstances changing and I'm an empty nester now and suddenly have more time and more availability, but guess what? All the internal obstacles now come roaring in and they were just waiting there. And for some reason I thought once the time and the circumstances changed that, then I would just feel so freed to be able to create. And instead now it's time to deal with all those internal, all that resistance that we feel, which that resistance is, it's natural and it's normal, but I think it does cause a lot of people to, if not quit, at least delay and procrastinate. And it's all about fear. We know it's all about fear. It's, fear of rejection, fear that our work will be rejected, or fear that we ourselves will be rejected, that people will think we're strange or weird or wasting our time or, whatever that might be, or we might finally create this thing and put it out there and no one likes it and it's not valued or rewarded or appreciated. And, it just kind of falls flat there and is just sad. And, so it's a lot of fear. And I think there's disappointment that comes along the journey too. That's also inevitable. There's disappointment that the work is not what we hoped it would be, that we've made this thing and we had a vision for it and it does not match our vision, which I'm convinced that, Michelangelo felt that, that every great artist who ever made anything dealt with the disappointment that the vision and the reality, didn't match like they'd hoped. But there's also, I think, disappointment in that we hit the limits of our ability at some point. And none of us are as talented as we wish we were. And that's just reality, And so we make this thing and it's the best we can make. And it still feels like not only is it not up to our vision, but we realize we can't do any better. and that's a disappointment. That's
right.
That's difficult. And, you know, to be able to push past that and still create, I think is really challenging. So, yeah. So there's a
you
lot
know, of- it's interesting. Yeah. When I was teaching creative writing, I would have some students, I taught at a really small school. So if in order to do the art credit, their choices were very limited. They had to do visual art, drama, or creative writing. And so I got, you know, we all had our little reluctant students, but my very best, one of my very best writers I ever had in class was one who came in saying that he hated writing. And I, you know, after a couple weeks of reading his writing and seeing how wonderful it was, I was like, what are you talking about? And come to find out the reason he hated writing is because he could never get it to be what he wanted it to be. And so he is one of just a handful of students. He's actually a professional writer now. He's a journalist. But once I saw that and I said, well, that's normal. He didn't know that was normal. But really, I think sometimes those who are the most gifted are also the most frustrated because their imagination is so alive and they see the gap between what they can do and what they wish they could do.
And the more you pursue and learn, the more sometimes that gap widens instead of closes.
Yes.
Which, you know, is also its own little form of discouragement. There's so many things to discourage this writing life or this creative life. It's hard. It's hard.
So why do we do it?
Why do we do it?
I saw this illustration. I think it was like some comics artist like posted something where it's like the progression of your mood. If you're an artist and you're trying to create an art where you get the idea and it's this huge peak, you're like, oh, this is an amazing idea. Yes. I love it so much. I'm so jazzed about it. Then you start creating it and you're like, this is a mess. It's nowhere near what I pictured it was going to be. I pictured this sort of vague glittering thing in the sky. And it's just like this pile of stuff on the ground. And then that's where it's very easy to give up. And I'm sure I've abandoned more projects than I should have at that stage. But then the trick is to take it from the heap of stuff on the ground and get it as close as you can to that original goal. It'll never quite get there. I loved what you said, Tracy, about like even Michelangelo is probably looking up at the Sistine Chapel like, it's not how I pictured it.
Yeah.
But you need to keep getting it. You need to keep going. And I think you also mentioned how, you know, all of us reach the limits of our ability at some point. Even like the super talented people reach the limits. I'm thinking like the Divine Comedy. You can see Dante, who might be who's among the greatest writers who's ever lived. He's reaching topics at the end when he's in paradise, where it's like, ooh, language isn't quite working anymore. He's reached the limits. So what are we all supposed to do here? And it seems like there's always some sort of internal struggle, even if the external struggles aren't there. So Tracy, when you feel those internal struggles, what are your methods for pressing on when it's so much easier to quit?
Well, I will tell you what I think is the key, the secret.
I'm so excited.
Yes. No, I don't know. This is kind of one of the things that I've been exploring through the writing of this book, because, you know, I'm trying to give Kelsey, my main character, some answers, but, you know, obviously she's the stand-in for all of us who are trying to pursue creativity. So I think what I've come up with, what I'm pondering these days, is that the secret is, and this is going to sound trite when I say it, but the secret is love. The secret is that we love the world through our work, that we love the world unconditionally through our work. So that means that we generously give of what we have, of our best, and then we don't expect anything in return, because that's what unconditional love is. And that means we work at our art, we rework it, and we don't demand affirmation, and we don't demand reward, and we don't demand anything, because we are unconditionally loving the world with our work, because that's what we've been given to do. We've been gifted to create, and so we create because we create out of love.
So. Oh, I love that. That is... That I Thank you for that. I need to write that down. wait, I have it on recording. I think no. That also makes me think of when we had Jane Charles, our resident. Well, not anymore. She moved to Michigan, but Jane, our poet, our lovely poet friend, and she was talking about how she doesn't even fear rejection because she loves the process. And just working through that creativity that that she's been given. But I like what you said goes even a step further to say, I thought you were going to say because we love the work, but you said because we love the world through the work. And that's a whole other way of thinking about it that I love.
I think that thinking of it as a gift that we give, you know, it's a gift that we are given, but it's a gift that we give, and it's not a transaction. It's a gift. And so we give it, and we understand that we're small and that we're limited and that our contribution might be quite ordinary. It doesn't, you know, it's not going to set the world on fire. It's not, you know, it's not the best there ever was. It's just what I can give. And so, you know, that's, I think, what I'm trying to learn, that we're still critical, that we're part of that greater story. And so no matter how small the part or how limited the talent or whatever, we have the responsibility to step into that and to give that gift. And one of the things that I discovered in the writing of this book was I wanted to think about the word amateur, and discovered that the Latin is just from the word for love. You know, amator means lover. And that, you know, we've made that such a pejorative term, amateur, right? It's like, oh, you're such an amateur, because to be a professional is the high calling or the affirmed and legitimized creative pursuit. But to be an amateur is just to love, is to love the work and the world, I think. And and there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing, you know, we don't have to reach that pinnacle of success in order to feel like we've done what we needed to do.
Well, it makes the work noble and courageous. Yeah. So one of the internal obstacles that I find, and this is probably going to touch on some of the things you were just saying, is I find myself comparing my work to other people's work, my work to work I've done before. Would you have anything to add or when that's the obstacle you're facing?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I touched on that a little bit too in the book, because I was exploring all the things that I struggle with, and that's one of them too. And I think that's pretty natural. You know, I think we're always comparing. You know, it's never probably healthy, but it's pretty natural and typical.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I put these words in the mouth of one of the characters, but it was something that I was thinking about, that what does comparison really do for us? I think it either leads to pride or it leads to pessimism. Those are the only two ways. Like, you're never going to compare yourself to someone and feel that you are exactly equal, you know?
Right.
It's always going to be, it's like, you know, this little tiny point on the line that, you know, there's no way you're going to balance on that tiny point and say, oh yes, this person's right here with me. You know, you're always going to say I'm better than, or I'm worse than. It's always going to go one way or the other way. And so, yeah, either it's going to lead to pride, that you're better than others, or even, I think, sometimes resentment. You know, you're looking at the books that seem like they're not as good as what you're writing, and yet you see them getting the affirmation and getting the contracts or getting the bestseller list or whatever, and you're thinking, that's not fair. And so then resentment comes, and cynicism and all that. Or you're looking at your work and thinking, you know, there's people I read and I think, oh my goodness, I will never write like this. Like, it's crushing, but I will never write this well. I know I won't. And so then it's like, well, why bother? You know? And that is when I get to that place in the story that, you know, that Matt was talking about, that, like, where, you know, you start out with a great idea and you're loving it, and then you get to the middle and you're like, this is garbage. Why am I even bothering my family? It's like a joke with my family, because, you know, somebody will say, how's the book going? And I'll be like, it's terrible. It's awful. It's the worst thing I've ever written. And the response is always, oh, that's where we are in the story? Oh, okay.
Exactly.
So that's the phase we're in now? Okay. Like, there's that's not even funny. Any, you know, sympathy or empathy for me at all. It's just like, oh, okay, yeah, that's where you are. I'm going to ignore that now. And they almost know the word count point, I think. Like, you know, I think my husband would be like, oh, I guess you're like, what, 40,000 words in, something like that.
To ask you if it was 40,000 words, that's mine. Ah, that's so funny. I was at 42,000 words and I just crashed and could not write for 2 weeks. Oh, that is so funny. Girl. Yeah. And I also find, back to the comparison thing, because that I think is my biggest inner obstacle is comparison, which of course is partly because of fear and all the other things that are, but I have found there are certain authors I can't read if I'm writing because I like them too much. Like you were saying, Tracy, when you just go, oh, I can't write like that. So I have to stop. I can't do that. Like I can't read Harper Lee. There's only one book by her, but only one legitimate book. But
yeah, I was going to say you should read the second book. Then you would feel better if you just read the other one that came out after she died. Then you would feel better.
Maybe I should read that. I do own that and I haven't read it. There's the key. But yeah, so the danger is either I'll just be flattened and I think, well, I'll never write as good as this. Or when I read Shirley Jackson books, it totally twists up my writing and I end up writing really dark stuff that does not really work with the way that I write. So yeah, you got to be careful of your intake when you're concentrating on output.
Yeah. To that point, very briefly, I've realized I cannot read Cormac McCarthy when I'm writing because I end up, my writing turns into a bad Cormac McCarthy impersonation. So yeah, that's so just awful.
Lots and lots of run-on sentences. Yeah. I think we talked about that before. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I can't do that. But yeah, there is that danger of comparison and it can go either way and either one is dangerous. There's a comparison like, oh, this is so good. I could never write like that. And then you feel all depressed that way. Then there's the other one, which I think all of us find every now and then. It's like, this book's really popular. And it's not even very good. How come this person gets a popular? And that's bad too. So it's hard to keep the balance. Where it's like, okay, I have what I have and just not compare it with others. You know, my gift is my gift and that's what I have. So let's not, what is it? Comparison is the thief of joy. And that's very true.
Like you think about, if you think it's, sometimes it's easier for me to, if I think about an art form that I don't even try to do and I remind myself of this. So for example, Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald, their voices could not be more different. But I am so glad that we live in a world where we had both of them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And I think also that, you know, We go to comparison when we're trying to create something that we think is going to be like top of form, you know, whatever it is. Mm, mm-hmm. And I just think that there's so much more space in the world for art that is not necessarily top of form, you know, that we need more art than that. Like if all we had was the greats, if all we had was the, you know, the absolute best, we wouldn't have enough. Like we need more art than that. And I think my mom is a great example. She's almost 80 and she paints wonderfully, but she has always felt like she was not a great painter and, you know, it doesn't necessarily do things that are very original. She likes to copy things, you know, she'll take a photograph and she'll paint, you know? So she feels like it's doesn't count, you know, but I mean, her talent is so far beyond what mine or most people I would meet is. And she actually, you know, read an early copy of this book and she said, so it's okay to just like paint my birds and give them out to people and they can, you know, hang them on their wall and like if they want to. Like I have her birds, you know, on my wall and framed and they're lovely. I love them. But she just feels like, well, you know, because she's not one of the greats that it doesn't count somehow. And I just think we all have to get over that. We all have to just be willing to make our contribution, you know, such as it is and be okay with that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I feel like in any other endeavor, we'd all be like, yeah, that's clearly true. You know, like very few of us who play sports as a kid go on to be a professional, but you wouldn't be like, ah, kid, I know you like basketball and you're 8 years old, but let's face it, you're probably not going to make the NBA, so you may as well give
Quit
up.
Now.
Like, yeah, exactly. Like that'd be obviously insane. But when it comes to artwork, that's how we all think. It's like, you're not the next William Faulkner. Yeah, you might as well give up. You know, like, but that is the attitude we put on ourselves.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't think we put it on other people either. That's, you know, not just with sports or whatever, but even with art, I don't think we put it on other people. We only put it on ourselves. You know, we don't look at, like, so this is one of the, like, kind of analogies I used in the book. Like, the guy that's strumming on his guitar, strolling around the Mexican restaurant while people are eating dinner. We don't look at him and say, well, that's a failed life. I guess you're probably miserable because all you're doing is playing this, you know, playing music at this restaurant. Like, we appreciate it and we love it. And we sit and listen to him and say, thank you. And we clap. And because he brought joy to us, you know, and that's okay. We need more than just the greats, you know, the absolute best. We need a lot more than that of art and beauty and waking people up and giving people that feeling of joy and that feeling of that longing that there is something more and the world is something more. We need a whole lot of that. And we can all be part of that, especially if we're gifted and we're called to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So that with all that said, and again, let's bring it to your forthcoming book that's coming out. Your book is, as we're recording, about to come out into the world. And like I said, when it's posted, it's probably brand new. So what are the takeaways that you're hoping your readers will get from the book? Like, they read the book, what are you hoping they'll come away with?
I think just encouragement for sure. I tried to write a great story too, so I don't want to make it sound like it's, you know, this is like a nonfiction book where it's just all about an agenda and I've got a whole bunch of preaching to do. It's, you know, hopefully it's a great story too. And I feel like people are enjoying it. The early readers are enjoying it just as a story and you know, it's just a piece of literature to escape into and enjoy. But I think for anybody who is pursuing a creative life or who feels that struggle at all, I would hope that they would put down the book and go pick up the pen, the paintbrush, sit down at the instrument. You know, that would be the feeling that you would walk away with, that yes, I am meant to do this. And so I need to, and I will. I just right before we started recording, I had an email from an early reader, and I wrote down the line she wrote in her email because I thought, oh, that's perfect. Basically, the way she ended her email, you know, after just talking about the book a little bit and what it meant to her, she said, "God created us to create. Who are we not to?"
Oh,
and I felt like great. That kind of summed it up for me. You know, like That's what I want. I want people to feel encouraged and, you know, love a good story and have fun with it, but also feel like it just frees them up and makes them ready to do what they're meant to do.
Awesome.
That's excellent.
Yeah. And we are running very low on time right now, but before we go, I want to do final pitch to the reader, to the listeners. Again, name of the brand new book as you're listening to this is Nightfall in the Garden of Deep Time. By Tracy Higley. And Tracy, where can we find you? Where can we buy your books? All of that good stuff.
So you can buy my books anywhere. You normally buy books. You'll find it. So that's not an issue. But if you want to look up me, particularly online, just tracyhigley.com. And it's T-R-A-C-Y and H-I-G-L-E-Y, Higley.com. And I would love to hear from your listeners. And especially, you know, if you want to read the book and you feel encouraged by it, let me know that was an encouragement to you, because that means a lot to me and encourages me.
Awesome. Well, thank you once again. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. And thank you so much.
And as y'all can probably tell, things are winding down at the Anselm Society Digital Pub. The fire is down to embers. The customers are trundling home and you've polished off your final glass. Once again, Believe to See is a podcast of the Anselm Society Arts Guild. Find out more about the Anselm Society, please visit us at anselmsociety.org. And while you're at it, please rate and review the show on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you again for joining us, and we'll see you next time.